the already enormously distinguished professor of physics at the University of P, dismissed with a few kind words in a handsome present the valet who looked after him, made a bonfire of his notebooks, packed in a valise a toothbrush, a change of shirts and underwear, and the choicest of his father's library of Kabbalistic books, took a taxi to the central railway station, bought a single ticket to the mountain resort of El, went to the correct platform where he purchased a pack of imported cigarettes and a net of tangerines from the kiosk, was observed by a porter to peel and consume a fruit, was seen by another porter to enter the gentleman's lavatory, and then vanished. He vanished so expeditiously, there were even obituaries in the press. In the years preceding the reality war, an itinerant showman who gave his name as Mendoza made a small living touring country fairs and carnivals with a small theater. This theater did not have any actors. It was a peep show cum cinematograph, but it offered moving views in three dimensions, and those who visited it were impressed by the lifelikeness of what they saw. Mendoza prospered. In time, he came to the Whitsun Fair in the capital with his theater, but by this time his art had progressed, and now he offered a trip in a time machine. Customers were invited to take off their clothes and don all manner of period costumes provided for them by the impresario. When they were suitably garbed, the lights dimmed and Mendoza projected upon a screen various old newsreels and an occasional early silent comedy. These films had, as it were, slots in them, in which the members of the audience could insert themselves and so become part of the shadow show they witnessed. I spoke with a man who, as a child, had been in this fashion an eyewitness of the assassination at Sarajevo. He said it had been raining heavily at the time, and everybody moved with the spasmodic jerkiness of clockwork figures. This showman, Mendoza, must have been one of Dr. Hoffman's first disciples, or even perhaps an early missionary. Hoffman's undergraduate class list included a fellow student named Mendoza, said to be psychologically unstable, who did not complete his course of study. But one day a drunken crowd burned down his booth, and Mendoza was burned with it, so badly that he died a few days later in some anonymous charity ward, attended by Sisters of Mercy. What linked him unambiguously to Hoffman had been his repeated mutterings, "Beware the Hoffman effect." On his bored, hard deathbed, under a cask of lint, he muttered away, and evidently none remembered. But now Mendoza was irretrievably dead, and the minister wondered if he were not a red herring. The minister had built up a hypothetical model of the invisible Dr. Hoffman, much as Dr. Drosselmeyer had built up a model of the unreality atom. From the scientist's academic record, we could see there was scarcely a branch of human knowledge with which he had not familiarized himself. We knew of his taste for the occult. We knew his height, his size in hats, shoes and gloves, his favorite brands of cigars, eau de cologne and tea. The minister's model was that of a crazed genius, a megalomaniac who wanted absolute power and would go to extreme lengths to grasp it. He thought Hoffman was satanic, and yet I knew my master too well not to realize he was tainted with a little envy for the very power the doctor abused with such insouciance, the power to subvert the world. This did not lessen my admiration for the minister. On the contrary, I was so lacking in ambition myself that the spectacle of his which ravaged him impressed me enormously. He was like a Faust who cannot find a friendly devil. Or if he had done so, he would not have been able to believe in him. The minister had all the Faustian desires, but since he had rejected the transcendental, he had clipped his own wings. In my meditative days, I used to think that a false legend was a warped vision of the myth of Prometheus, who defied the wrath of God to gain the prize of fire and was punished for it. I could not see what there might be wrong with knowledge in itself, no matter what the price. In spite of my post, I had taken no sides in the struggle between Dr. Hoffman and the minister. At times, I even speculated that Hoffman was altogether Prometheus and no Faust at all. For Faust had been content with conjuring tricks, where the manifestations around us sometimes looked as though they were formed of authentic flame. But I kept these thoughts to myself. Nevertheless, you must realize the adversaries were of equal stature. The minister possessed supernatural strength of mind to have stood out so long, and it was his phenomenal intransigence alone which upheld the city. Indeed, he had become the city. He had become the invisible walls of the city. In himself, he represented the grand totality of the city's resistance. His movements began to take on a megalithic grandeur. He said continually, "No surrender." And I could not deny his dignity. I even revered it. But for myself, I had no axe to grind. The siege went into its third year. Supplies of food were almost at an end. An epidemic of cholera decimated the eastern suburbs, and 30 cases of typhus had been reported that week. Even the discipline of the determination police was fraying, and now and then one of them would slip into the minister's office to tell tales on a colleague. My landlady vanished. Somehow, without anybody knowing, she was dead somewhere. So now I was alone in my house. Every day, the police suppressed riots with tear gas and machine gun fire. And it was blinding, humid, fetid summer, a summer that smelled of shit, blood, and roses. For there had never been such roses as those that bloomed that summer. They clambered everywhere and dripped as if perspiring the heaviest, most intoxicating perfume, which seemed to make the very masonry drunk. The senses fused. Sometimes these roses emitted low but intolerably piercing pentatonic melodies, which were the sound of their deep crimson color, and yet we heard them inside our nostrils. The citronade of the pale morning sun shimmered like a multitude of violins, and I tasted unripe apples in the rare green midnight rain. It was the day before my 24th birthday. In the afternoon, the cathedral expired in a blaze of melodious fireworks. It was our greatest national monument. It had been of immense size and architecturally sublimely chaste. Until then, its severe classical revival facade had grandly ignored all the doctor's whimsical attempts to transform it into a funfair or a mausoleum for sheep's figureheads or a slaughterhouse, so he finally detonated it with pyrotechnics. The minister and I watched the illuminations from our window. The dome rose up and dissolved against the clear blue sky of the middle of the afternoon like a fiery parasol. But, while I was faintly regretting that the spectacle had not taken place at night when I should have enjoyed it better, I saw that the minister was weeping. Berlioz crashed about us. We stood in the heart of a fantastic symphony, awaiting the climacteric death which would come in the form of a fatal circus. For my supper, I ate a salad of dandelions I picked from the wall of my house, which had begun to sprout flowers. I brewed myself a pot from my 4-weekly ounce ration of coffee substitute, and, I remember, read a little. I read a few pages of The Rape of the Lock. When it was time to sleep, she came to me. For the first time, I smiled at her. She made no response. I slept. And early the next morning, I awoke, and yet I knew I was still sleeping, for my bed was now, in fact, an island in the middle of an immense lake. Night was approaching, although I knew it was nearly dawn, for outside, that is, of the dream, a cock continued to crow. However, within my dream, the shadows of evening took the colors from the shifting waters around me, and a small wind rustled the quills of the pine trees, for my island was covered with pines. Nothing moved except this little lonely wind. I waited, for the dream imperiously demanded that I wait. And I seemed to wait endlessly. I do not think I have ever felt so alone, as if I were the last living thing left in the world, and this island and this lake were all that was left of the world. Presently, I saw the object of my vigil. A creature was approaching over the water, but it did not assuage my loneliness. For though I could see it was alive, it did not seem to be alive in the same sense that I was alive, and I shuddered with dread. I know I must have stood in an attitude of odd listening, as if to hear the scratching of the claws of the unknown on the outside rind of the world. The oldest and strongest emotion of mankind is fear. And the oldest and strongest kind of fear is fear of the unknown. I had been afraid when I was a child, when I would lie awake at night and hear my mother panting and grunting like a tiger in the darkness beyond the curtain. And I thought she had changed into a beast. Now I was even more afraid than I had been then. As it drew near, I saw it was a swan. It was a black swan. I cannot tell you how ugly it was, nor yet how marvelous it was. Its vapid eyes were set too close together on its head and expressed a kind of mindless evil that was quite without glamour. Though evil is usually attractive because evil is defiant. Its elongated neck had none of the grace traditionally ascribed to the necks of swans, but lolled foolishly, now this way, now that, like a length of hose. And the beak, which was the clear pinkish scarlet of scentless roses, striped with a single band of white, was flat, broad, and spatulate, fit only for grubbing worms from mud. It swam remorselessly and terribly towards me, but when only a few yards of shifting water lay between us, it paused to unfurl its enormous wings as if it were opening a heraldic umbrella. I have never seen such blackness, such a soft, feathered, absolute black, a black as intense as the negation of light, blacker the color of the extinction of consciousness. The swan flexed its neck like a snake about to strike, opened its beak, and began to sing, so that I knew it was about to die. And I knew, too, she was a swan, and also a woman, for there issued from her throat a thrilling, erotic contralto. Her song was a savage, wordless lament with the dramatic cadences of flamenco, in a scale the notes of which were unfamiliar to me, yet seemed those of an ultimate platonic mode, an elemental music. The shadows deepened. Yet one last ray of the invisible sun drew a gleam from a golden collar around her throbbing throat. And on the collar was engraved a single word, Albertina. The dream broke like a storm, and I woke. The room was full of muffled sunlight. The cock had ceased to crow. But I did not wake properly, even though my eyes were open. The dream left my mind full of cobwebs, and I scarcely saw the morning, though I went as usual to the office and found the minister going through his mail. He was studying a letter which had arrived in an envelope bearing the postmark of one of the solid suburbs in the north of the city. He began to laugh softly.
Dr. Hoffman's special agent would like me to take him to lunch today, he said, and handed me the letter. Test this immediately.
It went through innumerable computers. It went through reality testing laboratories A and B, and we photocopied it before it went through laboratory C. This was fortunate, for it was authentic. I was to go with the minister to the rendezvous. My task was simple. I was to record every word that passed between the minister and the agent on a very small tape recorder concealed in my pocket. He sent me home to change my suit and put on a tie. I must say, most of all, I was looking forward to a good meal, for such things were hard to come by nowadays. Yet I could see what the minister could not, that Dr. Hoffman would not have sent him an invitation had he not believed we were on our knees. The restaurant was luxuriously discreet. All its staff had unimpeachable reality ratings, even the plongeurs. We waited for our contact in a dim, confidential bar, too comfortably redolent of money to be affected by the tempest of fantasy we could not glimpse outside, because the windows were so heavily curtained. Sipping his gin and tonic, the minister alternately consulted his watch and tapped his foot. I was interested to see he was unable to perform these actions simultaneously. Perhaps because he was so single-minded. He emanated tension. A muscle twitched on his cheek. He lit a fresh cigarette from the butt of the one he had just put out. We knew who it was the instant our contact came in, because the lights immediately fused. A dozen tiny fireflies clicked into life at the nozzle of a dozen cigarette lighters. But I could make out only the vaguest outlines of Dr. Hoffman's emissary, until the waiters brought in a number of branched candlesticks so that he was illuminated like the icon he resembled. A breeze seemed to play about him, tossing the small flames hither and thither, keeping constantly aflutter the innumerable ruffles on his lace shirt, and casting a multitude of shadows over his face. Presumably he was either of Mongolian extraction, or else he numbered among his ancestors, as I did, certain of the forgotten Indians who still linger miserably in the more impenetrable mountains, or skulk along the waterways. For his skin was like polished brass, at once greenish and yellowish. His eyelids were vestigial, and his cheekbones unusually high. Luxuriantly glossy hair, so black it was purplish in color, made of his head almost too heavy a helmet to be supported by the slender column of his neck. And his blunt-lipped, sensual mouth was also purplish in color, as if he had been eating berries. Around his eyes, which were as hieratically brown and uncommunicative as those the ancient Egyptians painted on their sarcophagi, with thick bands of solid gold cosmetic, and the nails on his long hands are enameled dark crimson, to match the nails on his similarly elegant feet, which were fully exposed by sandals consisting of mere gold thongs. He wore flare trousers of purple suede, and used several ropes of pearls for a belt around his waist. All his gestures were instinct with a self-conscious but extraordinary reptilian liquidity. When we rose to go to eat, I saw that he seemed to move in soft coils. I think he was the most beautiful human being I have ever seen. Considered that is solely as an object, a construction of flesh, skin, bone, and fabric. And yet, for all his ambiguous sophistication, indeed, perhaps in its very nature, he hinted at a savagery which had been cunningly tailored to suit the drawing room, although it had been in no way diminished. He was a manicured leopard, patently in complicity with chaos. Secure in the armor of his ambivalence, he patronized us. His manner was one of wry, supercilious reserve. He was no common agent. He behaved like an ambassador of an exceedingly powerful principality visiting a small, but diplomatically by no means insignificant state. He treated us with the regal condescension of a first lady. And the minister and I found ourselves behaving like boorish provincials who dropped our forks, slopped our soup, knocked over our wine glasses and spilled mayonnaise on our ties, while he watched us with faint amusement and barely discernible contempt. In a gracious attempt to put us at our ease, he chatted desultorily about the Baroque music in a low, dark voice, which had a singular, furry quality. But the minister refused to talk small talk. He spooned his consommé distastefully, grunting now and then. His cold eyes fixed suspiciously on the luring siren before us, who ate with an unfamiliar but graceful series of gestures of the hands, like those of Javanese dancers. I drank my soup and watched them. It was like the dialogue between a tentacular flower and a stone. A waiter took away the plates and brought us Sole Véronique. You would not have believed we were at war. The young man spilled a grape with his fork. He folded up Vivaldi and his lesser-known contemporaries and put them away. As we dismembered our fish, the following conversation took place. I found the tape in a lead coffin in the ruins of the Bureau of Determination many years later, and so am able to transcribe it verbatim. Ambassador,
Dr. Hoffman is coming to storm the ideological castle of which at present, my dear minister, you are the king.
This was a minor, preliminary sortie. He fluttered his darkened lashes at us and tinkled with diminutive laughter. Minister,
He has made his intentions in that direction abundantly clear.
As far as we can tell,
he opened hostilities perhaps 3 years ago, and by now there are no directions left in the city where the clocks no longer answer to the time. Ambassador.
Yes, indeed. The doctor has liberated the streets from the tyranny of directions, and now they can go anywhere they please. He also set the timepieces free, so that now they are authentically pieces of time, and can tell everybody whatever time they like. I am especially happy for the clocks. They used to have such innocent faces. They had the watermelon-munching, opaquely-eyed visages of slaves, and the doctor has already proved himself a horological Abraham Lincoln. Now he will liberate you all, Minister.
Minister. But ought the roads to rule the city?
Ambassador. Don't you think we should give them a crack at the whip now and then? Poor things, forever oriented by the insensitive feet of those who trample them. Time and space have their own properties, Minister. And these, perhaps, have more value than you customarily allow them. Time and space are the very guts of nature. And so, naturally, they undulate in the manner of intestines.
Minister, I see you make a habit of analogies.
Ambassador,
an analogy is a signpost.
Minister, you have taken away all the signposts.
Ambassador,
but we have populated the city with analogies.
Minister,
I should dearly like to know the reason why.
Ambassador, for the sake of liberty, Minister.
Minister, what an exceedingly pretty notion.
Ambassador, I certainly did not think that answer would satisfy you. What if I told you that we were engaged in uncovering the infinite potentiality of phenomena?
Minister, I would suggest you moved your operations to some other location.
The ambassador smiled and dissected a translucent sliver of soul.
Minister,
I began to perceive a short while ago that the doctor intended utterly to disrupt any vestige of the social fabric of my country, of which he himself was once one of the finest intellectual ornaments.
Ambassador, you speak of him as if he were a piece of famille rose.
The minister ignored this gentle reprimand.
Minister, I can only conclude he is motivated purely by malice.
Ambassador,
what, the mad scientist who brews up revengeful plagues in his test tubes? Were his motives so simple, he would by now, I assure you, have utterly destroyed everything.
The minister pushed back his plate. I could see he was about to speak direct from the heart.
Minister,
yesterday the cathedral dissolved in a display of fireworks. I suppose the childish delight many showed when they saw the rockets, the Catherine wheels and the varicolored stars and meteors affected me most of all. For the cathedral had been a masterpiece of sobriety. It was given the most vulgar funeral pyre that could possibly have been devised. Yet it had brooded over the city like the most conventual of stone angels for 200 years. Time, the slavish time you despise, had been free enough to work in equal partnership with the architect. The masons took 30 years to build the cathedral, and with every year that passed, the invisible molding of time deepened the moving beauty of its soaring lines. Time was implicit in its fabric. I am not a religious man myself, and yet the cathedral stood for me as a kind of symbol of the spirit of the city. It was an artifice?
Ambassador. And so we burned it down with four d'artifice.
The minister ignored him. Minister.
And its grandeur, increasing year by year as it grew more massively into time itself, had been programmed into it by the cunning of the architects. It was an illusion of the sublime, and yet its symmetry expressed the symmetry of the society which had produced it. The city, and by extension the state, is an artifice of a similar kind, a societal structure.
The ambassador raised his beautiful eyebrows at these words and tapped his painted nail against his teeth, as though in amused reproof of such jargon.
Minister, intransigently. A societal structure is the greatest of all the works of art that man can make. Like the greatest art, it is perfectly symmetric. It has the architectonic structure of music, a symmetry imposed upon it in order to resolve a play of tensions which would disrupt order, but without which order is lifeless. In this serene and abstract harmony, everything moves with the solemnity of the absolutely predictable, and here the young man interrupted him impatiently.
Ambassador, go in fear of abstractions.
Pettishly he consumed the last crumbs of fish and fell silent until the waiters had replaced the plates with, to my delight and astonishment, Tornados Rossini. The ambassador brusquely dismissed an offering of pomme allumette. When we spoke again, his voice had deepened in color.
Ambassador, our primary difference is a philosophical one, Minister. For us, the world exists only as a medium in which we execute our desires. Physically, the world itself, the actual world, the real world, if you like, is formed of malleable clay. Its metaphysical structure is just as malleable.
Minister.
Metaphysics are no concern of mine.
The ambassador's hair abruptly emitted a fountain of blue lights, and suddenly Charlotte Corday, he pointed a dagger at the minister.
Ambassador.
Dr. Hoffman will make metaphysics your business.
The minister cut his meat phlegmatically.
I do not think so.
The words fell from his mouth with so heavy a weight, I was surprised they did not drop straight through the table. I was deeply impressed by his gravity. It quenched even the enthusiasm I had experienced at mining a black gem of truffle from my wedge of pâté. For it was the first time I had experienced the power of an absolute negative. The ambassador visibly responded to this change in tone. If he instantly ceased to look like an avenging angel, he also instantly became less epicene.
Ambassador, please name your price. The doctor would like to buy you.
Minister.
No.
Ambassador.
Allow me to suggest a tentative figure. 5 provinces, 4 public transport systems, 3 ports, 2 metropolises, and an entire civil administration.
Minister.
No.
Ambassador.
The doctor will go even higher, you know.
Minister.
No.
The ambassador shrugged, and we all continued to eat our delicious meat until it was gone. And the salad came.
We were drinking a red wine.
The skin of the ambassador's throat was so luminously delicate, one could see the glowing shadow of the burgundy trickle down his gullet after he had taken a sip.
Ambassador,
the doctor's campaign is still only in its preliminary stages, and yet he has already made of this city a timeless place outside the world of reason.
Minister, all he has done is to find some means of bewitching the intelligence. He has only induced a radical suspension of disbelief. As in the early days of the cinema, all the citizens are jumping through the screen to lay their hands on the naked lady in the bathtub.
Ambassador, and yet, in fact, their fingers touch flesh.
Minister, they believe they do, yet all they touch is substantial shadow.
Ambassador, and what a beautiful definition of flesh. You know I am only substantial shadow, Minister, but if you cut me, I bleed. Touch me, I palpitate.
Certainly I had never seen a phantom who looked at that moment more shimmeringly unreal than the Ambassador. No one who seemed to throb with more erotic promise. The Minister, however, laughed.
Minister,
whether you are real or not, I know for sure that I am not inventing you.
Ambassador, how is that?
Minister, I don't have enough imagination.
Now it was the Ambassador's turn to laugh, and he paused and halted for a moment, as if listening to an invisible voice. It was a childish trick, but remarkably effective.
Ambassador,
the doctor's offer has just risen by 4 opera houses and the cities of Rome, Florence, and Dresden before the fire. We will throw in Johann Sebastian Bach as your Kapellmeister to clinch the bargain.
Minister, dismissively, come now, we are well at work upon our countermeasures.
Ambassador, yes, indeed. We have been watching the progress of your electronic harem with considerable interest.
I had never thought of the Minister's computer center as an electronic harem. The simile struck me as admirable, but the Minister bit his lip.
Minister,
how?
The Ambassador ignored this question.
Ambassador, you are in the process of tabulating everything you can lay your hands on. In the sacred name of symmetry, you slide them into a series of straitjackets and label them with, oh my God, what inexpressibly boring labels.
Your mechanical prostitutes welcome their customers in an alien gibble wholly denied to the human tongue, while you, you madam, work as an abortionist on the side. You murder the imagination in the womb, Minister.
Minister, somebody must impose restraint. If I am an abortionist, your master is a forger. He has passed off upon us an entire currency of counterfeit phenomena.
Ambassador, do you regard the iconographic objects, or shall we say, symbolically functioning propositions which we transmit to you, as a malign armory inimical to the human race of which you take the city to be a microcosm?
The Minister put his knife and fork together symmetrically on his empty plate and spoke with great precision.
Minister, I do. The Ambassador leaned back in his chair and smiled the most seductive of smiles.
Ambassador,
then you are wrong. They are emanations only of the asymmetric, Minister, the asymmetric you deny. The doctor knows how to pierce appearances and to allow real forms to emerge into substantiality from the transparency of immanence. You cannot destroy our imagery. You may annihilate the appearances, but the asymmetric essence can neither be created nor destroyed, only changed. And if you disintegrate the images with your lasers and your infrared rays, they only revert to their constituent parts and soon come together again in another form, which you yourself have rendered even more arbitrary by your interference. The doctor is about to reveal the entire truth of the cosmogony. Please wait patiently. It will not take much longer.
They brought us fruit and cheese. The ambassador cut himself a sliver of brie. Ambassador.
You do appreciate, Minister, that very soon death, in innumerable guises, will walk these teeming streets.
Minister. She does already. The ambassador shrugged as if to say, you have seen nothing yet. He pulled off a sprig of grapes. Ambassador.
Are you prepared to capitulate?
Minister. What are your master's terms?
Ambassador. Absolute authority to establish a regime of total liberation.
The minister ground out his cigarette and cut a portion of Stilton. From the bowl of fruit, he selected a cock's orange pippin. Minister.
I do not capitulate.
Ambassador. Very well. Prepare yourself for a long, immense, and deliberate derangement of the senses. I understand you have broken all the mirrors.
Minister.
That was to stop them begetting images.
The ambassador produced a small mirror from his pocket and presented it to the minister so that he saw his own face. The minister covered his eyes and screamed, but almost at once regained his composure and went on paring the skin from his apple. The walls of the world did not cave in, and the feline smile of the ambassador did not waver. The meal concluded. The ambassador refused coffee, but, with a return of his original de haut en bas manner, rose to bid us farewell. As he left the restaurant, all the flowers in every vase shed every single one of their petals. I switched off the tape recorder. Now I must rely on my memory. I myself ordered coffee, and the minister took his habitual black tea, though this afternoon he tipped into his cup the contents of a balloon of brandy. He had me play over the recording of their conversation, and then stayed sunk in thought for a while, lost inside a cloud of cigarette smoke. If I were a religious man, Desiderio, he said at last, I would say we had just survived an encounter with Mephistopheles. The minister had always struck me as a deeply religious man. Let me tell you a parable, he went on. A man had made a pact with the devil. The condition was this. The man delivered up his soul as soon as Satan had assassinated God. Nothing simpler, said Satan, and put a revolver to his own temple. Do you cast Dr. Hoffman as God or Satan?
The minister smiled.
As my parable suggests, the roles are interchangeable, he replied. Come, let us go.
But for myself, I was bewildered, for certain timbres in the young man's voice had reawakened all my last night's dream, and, as if his voice had struck those mysterious notes which are supposed to shatter glass, a fine tracery of cracks had all at once appeared in the surface of my indifference. The young man fascinated me. As the minister signed the check, I saw the curious ambassador had left behind him on the chair he had occupied a handkerchief of the same exquisite lace as the fabric of his shirt. I picked it up. Along the hem, stitched in a flourish of silk so white it was virtually invisible, was the name I had only seen before in my dream, the name Albertina. The hieratic chant of the black swan rang again in my ears. I swayed as if I were about to faint. The minister slipped the head waiter a fat tip and lit a fresh cigarette as he led me by the arm into the equivocal afternoon, where the sunlight was already thickening.
Desiderio, he said, how would you like to go on a little trip?
Chapter 2, The Mansion of Midnight. The minister was clutching at straws, but he clutched ferociously. That very morning, as I tasted the ambassador's letter in another part of the Bureau of Determination, the minister's computers had startled him by registering a significant analogy. They posited certain correspondences between the activities of the proprietor of a certain peep show who had operated his business upon the pier at the seaside resort of S throughout the summer, and now showed signs of quartering himself there for the winter. It seemed a small enough clue to me, hardly worth the importance the minister placed on it, and hardly enough to justify my new promotion. Nevertheless, promoted I was. Between lunch and tea time, I became the minister's special agent, and my mission was, if I could find him, to assassinate Dr. Hoffman as inconspicuously as possible. I was chosen for the mission because, A, I was in my right mind, B, I was indispensable, and C, the minister's computers decided my skill at crossword puzzles suggested a facility in the processes of analogical thought which might lead me to the doctor where everyone else had failed. I think the minister himself thought of me as a kind of ambulant computer. Even so, in spite of the encouraging voice with which he wished me farewell, I guessed it was something of a forlorn hope. The computers constructed me an identity sufficiently foolproof to take me past the checkpoints of the determination police, for I was the most secret of agents. I was to pose as an inspector of veracity first class. At the town of S, some 60 miles further up the coast, I was to make a special report on the mysterious affair of the mayor who had disappeared some time before. The inscrutable business of bureaucracy went on, war or no war, and my bureaucratic credentials were impeccable. I was issued with a small car, a complement of petrol coupons, and a pocket arsenal of revolvers, etc. I packed a bag with a notebook or two and a shirt. I took with me no souvenirs or objects of sentimental value because I had none. Even though I did not know when, if ever, I would see it again, I did not bother to say goodbye to my arid room. I left the city the next morning. As I passed the Bureau of Determination, I saw a slogan had appeared on the wall. It read, "Dr. Hoffman pisses lightning." I drove off through a gigantic storm. It was still before breakfast time, but the sky was so black that an unnatural darkness filled the streets which today, as if on purpose to speed my departure, had reverted to the forms I had always known. Streets without magic or surprise. Streets as boring as only those of home can be. I did not have much hope of returning to them, nor did I believe the city would survive very long after I had gone. Not only because I had always obscurely felt I was one of the invisible struts of reason which had helped to prop it up for so long, but because it seemed inevitable it would soon collapse. Yet I felt no nostalgia when, after I speeded up the interminable negotiations with the police by the gift of several cartons of the minister's cigarettes, I took the road that led north. I supposed, I hoped that, if the city fell, at least it would coffin the environment which bred my unappeasable boredom. There was nothing in the great heap of stucco, brick, and stone behind me to which I felt the least attachment, except the memory of a certain mysterious dream, and that I took with me. And if I felt a sudden excitement as the miles wound away beneath me, it was because of that dream and the name which seemed to shelter three magic entities: the Glass Woman, the Black Swan, and the ambassador. The name was a clue which pointed to a living being beneath the conjuring tricks, for such tricks imply the presence of a conjurer. I was nourishing an ambition to rip away that ruffled shirt and find out whether the breasts of an authentic woman swelled beneath it, and if around her neck was a gold collar with the name Albertina engraved upon it. And then I would fall on my knees in worship. Under all my indifferences, I was an exceedingly romantic young man. Yet, until that time, circumstances had never presented me with a sufficiently grand opportunity to exercise my pent-up passion. I had opted for the chill restraints of formalism only out of sharp necessity. That, you see, was why I was so bored. The appearance of the countryside had not altered. The flat fields of vegetables around the capital stretched, as before, to the horizon, and still seemed to produce nothing but commonplace roots and tubers. The villages had put up their shutters to keep out the rain, but otherwise looked as vindictively peasant as they'd always done. Even the scarecrows looked only like scarecrows. The road itself was the only casualty, or the first casualty, for the volume of wheel traffic was reduced almost to nothing, and already vigorous growths of weeds and flowers pushed up through the cracks in the asphalt while no holes had been repaired. So now brown troughs of water gaped everywhere. The drive took some hours more than it should have done. I reached my destination in the middle of the afternoon when a magnificent rainbow was arching over the town, and, together with a shimmering brilliance in the sky over the sea, it heralded the end of the downpour. As I drove into the suburbs, the rain first fell aslant and then ceased altogether. The sun came out and the pavements began to steam gently. S was a bright, pleasant, pastel-tinted town, redolent of dead fish and the wet-faced flannels, clean as if the abrasive sea scrubbed it twice a day. Before the war, families came out from the city to spend a summer fortnight at guest houses, where the doormats were always full of sand and the hallways littered with tin buckets and tiny spades. There was a pier made of such lacy striations of iron, it looked like the skeleton of an enormous bird or a drawing of itself made with a fine pin and Indian ink on a pale blue paper of the well-mannered sea. The fishermen lived at the other end of the beach in cheerful, whitewashed cottages overgrown with that summer's abundance of roses, and they hung out their nets to dry on picturesque and primordial poles, weighing them at the corners with balls of dark green glass. It was late August, and the shops offered pink rock, colored postcards, candy floss, straw hats, and all the appurtenances of the holiday maker. But, though all the doors were open, I could see no shopkeepers within, behind the counters, and the entire place was quite empty of humanity. Along the promenade, striped umbrellas cast pools of shade over deserted tables at which no ice cream eater sat, though there were plenty of saucers smeared with residual traces, and also glasses half full of pink, green, and orange drinks in which the ice had not yet melted, and the paper straws were still indented at the top from the pressure of lips. The pale acres of sand were empty, but for a few waddling seabirds, and I noticed a corpse who lay where the sand had left him, unattended but for a cloud of flies. There was nobody at the turnstile of the pier to take my coin. Some of the side shows were shuttered, but here half a dozen ping-pong balls bounced on jets of water, and the rifles were laid out in invitation to no cracksman. Though the bed was made up ready to tip the lady out, the lady herself
had vanished. Yet the loudspeakers blared cheerful music, and nowhere looked deserted. It was as if the entire population of the town had slipped off somewhere, called to witness some event to which I alone had not received an invitation, and would all be back at their posts in 5 minutes. A sea breeze blew the bright pennants this way and that way. I passed a fortune-teller's booth and another booth, which smelled of hot dogs simmering by themselves in a tin vat of hot water, and then, with most suspicious ease, I found my first quarry, the peep show. It was indeed the colored replica of the canvas tent I had seen in monochrome in the files of the bureau. Colored, but faded, left out too long in the rains of years. A sagging box of pink-striped canvas with a flap drawn up and held back with a fraying cord. A yellow playbill in old-fashioned lettering announced that the 7 wonders of the world in 3 lifelike dimensions awaited one inside, and I bent my head and stepped into the warm, dim cave. It was lit only by the beams of the afternoon sun, creeping in through the many gaps in the structure. A startled gull started up from a perch upon an iron wheel, with a wild beating of wings as I came in, and swooped around the interior until it found the exit. At the sound, an old man, whose sleeping shape had been obscured by the thick brown shadows, awoke with shouts and curses. There was a chink and the rumble of a rolling, overturned bottle, and the air filled with fumes of raw spirit. "Is there no peace?" demanded the old man, rearing like a seal from a rustling heap of straw, and instantly with a groan falling back. He was the first living thing I had seen since I arrived in the town, and he was nothing but a piece of verminous flotsam overgrown with a white weed of hair. There was not a single tooth left in his head, and a stained, matted beard straggled over the lower part of his face, while the upper part was hidden by a pair of wire-rimmed, green-tinted glasses, the left lens of which was cracked clean across. He wore the ruins of striped trousers and a dinner jacket, relics perhaps of more prosperous days, and no shirt, only a torn, filthy vest. His feet were bare. His blackened toenails had grown into claws. He poked about for a few moments until he gained a handhold on one of the curious machines which filled the tent and, clinging to it, steadied himself sufficiently to rise again. He looked in my direction but did not look at me. He looked all about the tent as if trying to locate me and then wearily shook his shaggy head. "Though this is by no means Gaza, yet I am eyeless," he said, and I knew for certain he was blind. "If you are a customer," he said, "please place 25 cents in the receptacle you will find placed for that purpose on the tea chest beside the door. And take your fill of the wonders of the world. But if not," he added, and his voice began to trail away, "then not. However, whatever you are, kindly restore me my bottle." When it rolled out to the middle of the floor, the bottle had spilled all it contained. "There isn't a drop left," I warned as I handed it to him. He shook it to hear if there was a rattle, sniffed the neck voluptuously, and then, leaning behind him, parted the canvas walls and dropped it into the sea below, where it gurgled and sank. "I have drunk sufficiently deeply of humiliation anyway," he said. "Please play your quarter, do your business, and go away." He relapsed on his pallet and made no more sounds but the murmurous roaring of his breathing. The saucer contained 2 trouser buttons, a shell, and a coin I identified as a Japanese 1-sen piece, long out of circulation.
But I put a quarter there, all the same. The machines were of ancient rusted cast iron, decorated with impressions of cupids, eagles, and knots of ribbons.